Ugh.
Kylo woke on a cold stone slab in a cold room. He didn't open his eyes. If he could have willed himself never to wake again, he would have. It was still, except for his breath and the currents of his lifeblood rushing through his veins. As always, when he came back from the dead, his body felt wonderful, absolutely whole, powerful, bursting with energy. He'd stolen a life, and it came to him abundantly. He was overfull, spilling life in every direction. His health was a mockery. Tears welled in his eyes and spilled down his cheeks to his ears. No wonder the wolf had thought him a monster. He thought Kylo was throwing away the lives of those he loved and who loved him. He lay on his back, but it only got worse. So he opened his eyes. The air was stale, dank. The ceiling was ornate, cool white marble. He was in a crypt. Only feet away on slabs like his were a man's body and a woman's. The man was big, holding a big sword. The woman's throat had been cut, and from how she'd decomposed, Kylo guessed she'd been bled dry. The man had died around the same time, surely during the coup. They were Logan's parents. Around them, the walls were filled with row upon row of Gaia corpses, stretching back centuries. Logan had put Kyler in his own family's crypt. Kylo stood, not even feeling stiffness from having slept on marble. He'd been dressed in a cloth of gold tunic and white breeches and fine fawn-skin shoes. It was, of course, pitch black in the crypt. There was no way of telling what time of day it was, and the mouth of the crypt was sealed with a massive rock cut into the shape of a wheel taller than a man. If Kylo remembered correctly, the crypt was located outside the city and sunk beneath the ground. If so, he had a good chance of getting out without anyone knowing. Regardless, he had to get out. So he grabbed the wheel and heaved with his talon. The massive stone rolled a half turn and settled into another rest. Kylo went invisible and stepped outside. It was night, but the harvest moon was bright and high overhead. In the narrow stairwell that led to the crypt stood a young girl, her eyes wide with fear. It was Blue, the little guttershite from Black Dragon Guild. Kylo stopped, still invisible, and rubbed his face. Blue didn't move. He could tell she wanted to run, but refused to. Brave little shite.
Kylo!
What was he supposed to do? Kill her? Avoid her and let her blab stories about the crypt opening? It was unlikely. But someone might open the crypt to check it out. And what would they do when they saw Kylo was gone?
Kylo, I know you're there. Take me with you.
Have you ever killed anyone, Blue?
No.
Do you want to kill people?
I'd kill Dag Torkus. He kicked Piggy in the stomach for stealing and the next day he died.
What if I told you that to be my apprentice you'd have to kill a dozen kids like Piggy? What if I told you you had to kill your whole guild? You just want out, don't you?
She nodded her head.
Then I need you to do two things, Blue. First, never, ever speak about this. If you tell anyone, bad people will find out, and they'll kill lots of good people. You understand? You can't even tell your best friend.
I got no friends, not after Piggy died.
Go to the corner of Verdun and Gar. I'll meet you in an hour.
Promise?
I promise.
Blue left, and Kylo closed the crypt. He found a safe house and loaded up everything he needed, including Retribution, which he had left before he killed the Queen, knowing his weapons would be confiscated. He wrote a note to Rimbold Drake, first explaining about the laundress he'd maimed and asked Drake to pay restitution, and then explaining what the wolf told Kyler he'd cost the Drakes. He grabbed several bags of gold and a few poisons and changes of clothing, took a cloak, and pulled the hood over his face. He found Blue sitting at the intersection. She scrambled to her feet.
Inside that house lives a good man, Blue. He was poisoned and nearly died during the coup, and the Kalidorans killed his wife and two of his daughters. He's the best man I know, and I think he might need you as much as you need him. In my note, I've asked him to raise you. He'll give you the only chance you'll ever have to make something of yourself. But it won't be easy. If you go in this house, you stay until you walk out a lady. Is that what you want?
A lady?
Say it.
I want to be somebody. I want to be a lady.
I believe you.
Kyla handed a bag of gold crowns to Blue. It was so heavy she could barely hold it. Then he put the note in her hand and threw back his hood so she would never doubt that it was him.
Blue, I'm trusting you. I see souls. I weigh them. From yours, I know you're worth it. Be good to Count Drake. I wasn't as good to him as he deserved.
With that, Kyla pounded on the door and went invisible. Rimbold Drake looked at Blue confused. She was too terrified to speak. After a moment, he took the note from her hand. He read it. Kyla turned to go.
You are better than you know. I forgive you any wrong you think you have done to me. You will always be welcome here, my son.
Kyla disappeared into the night. It was where he belonged. After 2 days, they moved Sullen to another room. It was still locked, the windows covered with bars, the cedar door banded with iron, but this room had a view of Whitecliff Castle's courtyard. The courtyard was decorated in a style fit for the wedding, greens the color of the vines and the seas, and the purples of wine and royalty dominating.
I don't know who you are, pretender.
The guard was a paunchy man with heavy jowls and haphazardly polished armor.
But enjoy the wedding. Because it's the last thing you'll ever see.
Why's that?
Because the Macedon wanted his first order as emperor to be your death.
The other guard, a rail-thin man with a single eyebrow, looked nervous and guilty.
Shut it, Ori! Nice horse's blood. It's gonna be a bad enough day as it is. We'll make it quick. I promise.
The man exited, watching Solon for any sudden movement, and locked the door behind himself. Solon was surprised to find a tub full of water and fresh clothes in the room. He scrubbed himself and donned the clean garments, thinking. Bashobi was already giving orders to Katie's guards. That couldn't be good. But it didn't necessarily mean what Solon suspected. Solon had never learned how much power Katie intended to share once she married. When she talked with him 2 days ago, she hadn't seemed desperate enough to grant Bashobi total power. It made him feel sick. For the last 2 days, he'd thought through every option he had, and he couldn't find anything that would assert his own rights without undermining Katie's. He didn't know what any of the political undercurrents were, so anything he did could have the opposite of the intended effect. But the clean clothes laid out for him, clothing fit for a noble, if not quite royalty, told him that Katie most likely hadn't intended him to die today. Was this his chance? Or was she punishing him by forcing him to watch a wedding that she saw as his fault? Outside, the nobles were gathering in order of precedence, standing as Sethi always stood to witness a wedding. Soon, at least 400 of them surrounded the platform where the Empress and Emperor-to-be would be wed. Solon could pick out many faces he recognized and saw a frightening number of absences, too. Had his brother killed so many? How had Sojourn become such a monster without Solon knowing? Then the betrothed entered. Solon's heart leapt to his throat as Katie strode forward. She wore a purple samite cape with a long train edged in lace. A crown of vines with ripe purple grapes was woven through her long black hair. It being her wedding, both of her breasts were bare, the nipples rouged, and beneath her navel, her bare stomach was adorned with ancient fertility rings. A cloth of gold skirt hung low on her hips, trailing slightly behind her, her wine-stained bare feet barely winking out. Most women exposed more of their ankles, saying the juice of the grape is clothing enough for a wedding. Apparently, Katie really did believe that a queen was a queen first and a woman sometime later. But after a decade and a half in Mid-Kiru, the modesty was lost on Solon. The sight of her here, like this, filled him with every sort of longing. The skirt had neither buttons, nor clasps, nor ties, nor underclothes beneath it. It was finished the morning of the wedding with the woman inside it. It was to be torn off by the groom in his passion. Revelers outside the wedding chamber would call loudly until the groom threw it out the window. In ancient times, and in some rural areas still, the skirt was always white and ripped open but not removed until the wedding was consummated. Then the revelers would parade with the proof of the woman's virginity, which, as often as not, was sheep's blood. Most mothers provided their daughters with a vial of it in case she had broken her hymen, licitly or illicitly. It was a tradition Solon was glad had mostly disappeared, not only because he thought it was gross, but also because he found it hard to imagine enjoying consummating his marriage with drunken, screaming assholes pounding on the walls. In the courtyard, Oshobi Takeda walked forward. Solon felt a stab of hatred. He should be walking forward now. He should be the one who tore Katie's skirt tonight. Oshobi Takeda came into the circle bare-chested as well, runes of vigor and potency painted on the surface of a stomach so muscular and devoid of fat that it wasn't flat, but ridged. He too wore vines through his hair and a simple green cape paired with cloth of gold trousers that ended just below the knee. Oshobi mounted the platform, barely looking at Katie. Solon thought he must be either blind or homosexual to disregard such beauty. He turned and addressed the assembled nobles.
I came here today to marry our empress. It was in my heart to unite this land, as it hasn't been united for more than a decade. I know all of us were dismayed when we heard of Don Warayamo's infidelities. And though it strained my family's honor, I came here determined to wait.
From his position, Solon could see what the nobles below could not. At every exit, armored city guards had lined up, and with them in irregular ranks stood many of the royal guards. The strength was, so far, hidden, but they could move in on the assembled nobles in moments. What Solon couldn't see was how Katie was taking this prologue to treason. He didn't have to wait long. Katie strode up onto the platform directly to Oshobi and slapped his face.
If you speak treason, Oshobi Takeda, I will have your head.
An older noble Solon recognized as Nore Oshibatu, long a friend of the Warayamos, shot a look at Oshobi and stepped forward.
My dear Katie, our beloved empress, you sound hysterical. This is not befitting. Please, he only speaks.
Nori pulled Katie back into the crowd where several other family friends closed around her. Oshobi smiled like the big cat he was.
I came here to serve Seth, but this very morning, I discovered something my honor could not countenance. Don Warayamo had on her person letters from the late Emperor's brother Solon to Katie. In these letters, he spoke of his tryst with her in the castle and of a secret marriage.
You lie!
Solon's heart sank. The trysts in the castle had only been attempted trysts, culminating in the disaster of her mother coming in on them naked and beating Solon with a shoe. It would have been worth it if she'd come in 10 minutes later. Or, well, he'd been a young man, maybe 2 minutes later. The marriage, of course, was a total fiction. But Oshobi was quick.
I have the letters here!
The nobles were in the predictable uproar, but Oshobi was wise enough that he didn't call his men forward. Someone had put a hand over Katie's mouth, and numerous men were restraining her.
So you see, even if we believe that Katie wasn't incestuous in her sluttish trysts in our nation's very heart, we know that she married Sigurjon Torfjusson, a marriage null and void because she was already married to the Emperor's brother!
Oshobi painted a sad look on his face.
I woke this morning willing to dishonor my family because I wanted to do what was right for our country.
Behind Solon, the door cracked open. He turned away from the courtyard to see his two guards enter.
All right. We already let you see more of the show than we were supposed to. You can figure how it turns out from here. You ready?
Yes. Which of you would like to die first? Huh? Together, then. Mortis Canus!
Solon took a sword and faced the barred window. Solon blew out the entire wall. Stones rained on the crowd 50 paces away. Everyone ducked and turned to see what was happening. Solon jumped down lightly and strode toward the crowd. A guard stepped in his path, wide-eyed and gulping. Solon gestured as if shooing a fly, and a wall of air flipped the guard aside.
I am Solonariwan Tofusin, son of Emperor Cressus Tofusin, Light of the West, Protector of the Isles, and High Admiral of the Royal Fleets of Seth. I have come home, and I call you a traitor and a liar, Oshimi. And even if your despicable lies were true, you have no claim to this throne while I live.
We can remedy that!
Solon advanced quickly onto the platform, not giving Oshobi time to think.
You would duel me? A Tofusin does not dirty his hands with the blood of a dog.
Solon's counterstruck cut halfway into Oshobi's neck.
However, I'll make an exception for a little cat.
Solon put his foot on the neck of his dying foe and pointed the sword at the nobles holding Cady.
That's your empress. I'd advise you to take your hands off her.
After riding most of the night, Kyla camped a short distance off the road, merely unsaddling Tribe and throwing a blanket on the ground. A few hours later, Tribe's snort woke him. Kyla blinked and rolled to his feet.
So you haven't forgotten everything I taught you?
A brown-clad figure led his horse to tie it next to Tribe.
Master?
It was odd to hear the sound, so characteristically Durzo coming out of the Yumuri's mouth. He glanced at retribution in Kyler's hand.
Good. I see you haven't managed to lose it again, yet. See that you don't, would you? You ready to ride?
Kyler felt an odd excitement. He did feel ready to ride. The overflow of energy from his invocation of immortality hadn't worn off yet.
I'm not dreaming this, am I?
There's one way to find out for sure.
What's that?
Go piss in the woods. If you feel wet and warm afterward, wake up.
Kyla went and relieved himself. When he came back, Devi was seated cross-legged and had laid out a huge, albeit cold, breakfast. Kyla tore into the food with gusto that surprised himself, though apparently not Devi. The scene still had an air of unreality, though, and Kyla kept glancing at him.
If you're looking for Durzo's mannerisms, you're going to see fewer and fewer of them. I don't chew garlic anymore, for one, and I'm getting rid of the rest as fast as I can. A new face isn't much good if you still do everything else the same. I have done this a few times, so if you need me to prove who I am, let's get it over with.
There is one thing Durzo told me that he never told anyone else. You've heard all these names, and you always picked something with meaning. Ferric, Fireheart, Galen, Starfire, Roth, and Steelbender. Even the other wet boys had names that meant something. Hugh Gibbet, Scarred Rabel. Why Durzo Blint? Is that another old Jaren pun?
Trick question. I never told you why I chose it. But to answer, it was supposed to be Durzo Flint. I was drunk. Someone repeated it Blint, and I didn't care enough to correct them. Next.
What does immortality cost?
Right to the gut, huh? Every new life costs the life of someone you love.
There it was. As simple as anything. If Durzo had told him that before the coup, everything would be different. Of course, Durzo had tried to tell him in the letter.
Is there any way to stop it?
You mean stop your immortality or stop it from killing someone else?
Either. Both.
The wolf never told me the limits. Maybe he didn't know himself. I avoided anything that would fully destroy my body, like burning or being drawn and quartered.
And Korok?
A fatal blow from Korok would blow apart the immortality magic. Jorsin feared the Devourer. He made sure there was at least one way to kill an immortal.
Kyler had a sudden feeling of dislocation. He was talking with someone who had known Jorsin Alcestis. Jorsin Alcestis. and Jorsen had feared the magic Kyla possessed.
What about stopping it from costing someone else's life?
You think in 7 centuries I didn't try? It's deep magic, kid. A life for a life. The wolf can delay it, but not stop it. And it's not easy even for him.
What if I were killed by Kurok during the time between me dying and the person who is going to die for me dying?
The look on Durzo's face made it clear that Kyler's question was far too specific for him to dismiss as theoretical.
Boy, you have no idea what Kurok is like.
Yes, I do. I threw it into Ezra's wood.
You what?
I made a deal with the wolf. I didn't get your note until afterward.
And what did he give you in return for the most powerful artifact in the world?
He brought me back to life faster and gave me my arm back, which I kind of cut off.
Durzo's flat stare was all too familiar, despite that it was coming through almond-shaped eyes. It suggested he was seeing previously undredged depths of stupidity.
And between assassinating a god king and a Cenarian queen and rescuing a man from the hole and making a king of him, when did you squeeze in the time to find and lose the world's most coveted magical sword?
It only took me a week. Nantano Garuwashi had it. I dueled him for it.
Is he as good as they say?
Better, and he's not even talented.
Then how'd you win?
Hey!
Kyla, I trained you. You're not the best. Someday, maybe. So either he's not as good as they say, or you got lucky, or you cheated.
I got lucky! Is it so bad, though? I mean, throwing Kurok in the wood?
Do you know who the wolf is?
That was the next question.
The better question is who the wolf was. No one knows what he is now.
I'll bite. Who was the wolf?
In Jorsen Alkesti's court, there was a mage with golden eyes. He was slightly less talented than Jorsen himself in terms of raw power. But whereas Jorsen had to learn the arts of war and leadership and diplomacy in addition to magecraft, the golden-eyed mage had only magecraft to study, and he was the kind of genius of magic born once in 1,000 years. He had few graces and fewer friends, but Jorsen meant the world to him. In the war, he lost everything. Jorsen, all his tomes of magic, his only other friend, Orin Raisin, and his fiancée. He lost his sanity too, and no one knows if he ever really regained it. He hid in the forest where he could work out his hatred. The forest, of course, took his name.
Ezra's Wood. The wolf is Ezra?
Jorsen had a close friend who betrayed him, a man named Roygaris Ursul.
Oh, God.
During the war, Roygaris made something out of himself. We called it the Reaver. It was impervious to magic, faster than thought. It killed thousands of us.
Durzo touched his cheek.
I was the first person to even wound it. My pockmarks are from where its blood sprayed me. Magic couldn't heal me. After the last battle, the Reaver was badly wounded. Instead of killing it, Ezra took it to the wood. 50 years later, there was a power struggle of some sort, and every living thing in that wood died, and dies to this day, whether animal, Kroll, mage, or the purest virgin. Armies from both north and south have perished there. Whatever it is, the wolf has been collecting artifacts for 7 centuries, and he gets the best of every deal.
What did you give him?
A couple of the Kakari. He wants them all. And Kurok and Iurs.
Iurs?
The companion to Kurok. The sword of power and the staff of law. Jorsen died the day Iurs was finished, before he could use it. No one knows what happened to it.
But what's the wolf trying to accomplish?
I don't know. Kyla, we've held one Kakari, and its power is awesome. Imagine what an archmagus could do with 7 Kakari and Kurok and Iurs. Even if the wolf is Ezra, would you trust a madman with that much power? Would you even trust yourself? What if the wolf isn't Ezra? What if it's Roygaris?
So you've opposed him?
After I gave him the brown Kakari, I thought better of it. Since then, I've scattered Kakari to the ends of the earth. This is no short-term ambition. It has taken the wolf 700 years to get a few Kakari, and now Churok, and perhaps Iurs. He doesn't care if it takes another 100 years to get the rest. This is part of your burden. Make sure he doesn't get them all.
But he might be on our side.
You tell that to all the innocents he's murdered.
What do I tell all the innocents you've murdered?
The problem with the Black Kokari is that it doesn't work in a mirror. I could never see the state of my own soul, and you can't see yours either. But if you wish, bring it to your eyes now, and judge me.
Kyla didn't dare. Durzo had poisoned dozens during the coup alone. There were surely hundreds, thousands more deaths on his soul. If Kyla saw profound guilt, he might not be able to stop himself from killing Durzo, or at least trying. It wasn't a fight he wanted to win, and now that he knew the cost of losing, that was even worse.
What should I do about the wolf?
Nothing now. But if you hear that Mount Tenji isn't spitting fire for the first time in 2 centuries, or you hear that Tlaxini Maelstrom has stilled, you need to move fast. Like I said, this is not a short-term threat.
When does it end?
His hand moved to his belt where he used to carry a small pouch of garlic cloves. He noticed and gritted his teeth.
It could be hundreds of years. It could be 20. Giving him Churok was a big mistake.
Thanks. Can we win?
We? I'm mortal now, kid. At best, I have 30, 40 years left. I'm not terribly interested in tangling with the wolf. Can you win? It's possible. He can't live forever. His magic's only an imitation of ours. Yours.
He made one Black Kokari. Why not make another one for himself?
Made it? No. Ezra found it. He studied it to make the others, but they were all inferior copies.
It told me...
Let me guess. Something about being crafted with limited intelligence. The Black Kokari was ancient when I was born, Kyla. It told you that so it wouldn't scare the shit out of you. You're sharing your head with a being whose power dwarfs yours.
Well, I wouldn't say my power exactly dwarfs yours.
Give the fucker my regards.
I loved you better than you loved yourself, Achilles.
I have to say, though, if he tells you to move, do it.
Right. Thanks.
The first time the Kokari had spoken to Kyler, it told him to duck. He hadn't, and had taken an arrow through the chest moments later.
Wait. You never answered my question about dying by Churok before the Kokari kills someone in my place.
Don't. It's not the Kokari that kills anyone. It's us. You're 20 years old, and you've died 5, 6 times. That's not the Kokari's fault.
Fine, it's my fault. Churok?
Dying by Churok might leave the person you love alive. Equally possible is that it will kill everyone you love. It's a feral magic. Churok means the Sunderer. It was not intended for gentle things. It's a bad gamble, kid.
This is all kind of a lot to absorb at once.
Then absorb while we ride. We're burning daylight.
They rode until dark and ate together, speaking only of inconsequential things. Kyla told Durzo everything that had happened in his absence. Durzo laughed, sometimes in the wrong places, as if laughing at similarities to his own memories, but more frequently than Kyla remembered him ever laughing before. Then Durzo began telling stories. Kyla was surprised to find him an excellent raconteur.
I was a bard one life. I took it up to train my memory. I wasn't very good.
Some of the stories he told were familiar from bard's tales Kyler had heard, though the details were very different. He told of a young Alexan the Blessed, caught with dysentery in the mountains during his first campaign, taking off his plate cuisses and dropping his male trousers to squat in the bushes, and then getting ambushed. His descriptions of Alexan fighting with a sword in one hand and trying to hike up his armor with the other had Kyler howling. Then Alexan tumbled down the mountain and fell 100 feet. They caught him at the bottom without a scratch or his trousers, which had caught in a tree 10 feet from the bottom of the ravine, slowing his fall and saving his life.
The Tomai use shitting as an intensifier. Like we might say someone was damn lucky, they said he was shitting lucky. That's why they called him Alexan the Shitting Lucky. Later, some prude translated it Alexan the Blessed. He was a good kid. Broke my heart to kill him. But he needed killing by the end.
Kyla looked at his master intently.
You're different now.
Durzo said nothing for a long time. He was like a caterpillar half-metamorphosed. One minute, he was the old hard-as-nails Durzo. The next, he was this laughing, reminiscing stranger.
The wolf has worked with me for almost 700 years. Ezra and Rhaegaris were the best healers ever. Whichever the wolf is, he's seen me die and come back dozens of times. He knows the magic and how exactly the Kokari worked with my body. But he isn't a prophet. At least not a natural-born one, unlike Dorian. So even with all his magic, he can only get bits and pieces. When I died, I think he spent a long time trying to figure out if my being alive one more time would help him or hurt him. Then he decided to raise me.
Kyla wondered about that. The wolf had said Durzo's resurrection was a mystery, a gift. Was he simply being modest? Or did he really not know how Durzo had come back?
Anyway, by the time the wolf started working on me, my body had pretty much rotted away. So, I feel like a new man.
So this life is different, isn't it?
Sometimes to love is easy, but to accept love is hard. I used to always be the man who led the charge. The Devourer steals that. Tell me, what kind of man would put his 8-year-old daughter at the spear tip of a cavalry charge? A monster. But what kind of man would refuse to fight when his enemies threaten all he holds dear? That's why I trained relentlessly. That's why I became the perfect killer. Because every time I wasn't good enough, I murdered someone I loved. I thought I finally defeated love when the Kokari abandoned me. But then there you were in the tower, standing athwart fate and crying no. I realized three things as your crazy ass dove into the river. First, you cared about me.
Kyla nodded silently. To hear Durzo say it without scoffing was alien, and the man seemed to marvel at it himself.
I knew your regard wasn't easily won, and I knew you'd seen darker sides of me than I'd let even most of my wives see. You know, I can ignore it when Count Drake loves me. He's a saint. He cares about everybody. No offense, but you're no saint.
Kyla smiled.
Second, I tried to root out feeling anything at all with drinking and whoring and killing and isolation. And I'd made myself into a monster. But I still failed. I still cared about you more than I cared about myself. That tells me something about myself.
And third?
Third? Oh, hell, I don't remember. Oh, wait. I spent years beating into your skull how hard and unfair life is. And I wasn't wrong. There's no guarantee that justice will win out or that a noble sacrifice will make any difference. But when it does, there's something that still swells my chest. There's magic in that. Deep magic. It tells me that's the way things are supposed to be. Why? How? Hell, I don't know. This spring, I'll turn 700, and I still don't have it figured out. Most poor bastards only get a few decades. Speaking of which, I've got bad news.
Speaking of which, which?
Life being unfair and all that.
Oh, great. What is it?
Luke Grayson. Kid you died on the wheel to save?
It was more for Logan than for Luke, but what about him?
Hanged himself.
What? Who killed him? Scarred Rabel?
No, he really hanged himself.
Are you joking? After what I did for him? That asshole!
Durzo grabbed his blanket and lay down, resting his head on his saddle.
Letting someone die for you can be tough. If anyone should understand that, it's you. Get up in 3 seconds. I'm gonna nail you with a biscuit. One.
Kyla struggled to open his eyes.
Three.
Kyla's eyes shot open and he snatched the hard biscuit out of the air with such force that it exploded into crumb shrapnel.
Damn it! What'd you do that for?
Fun.
Kyla scowled. There was something different about his master. His eyes seemed a little more round, his skin a little lighter. The shirt he was wearing tighter across the chest and shoulders.
What are you doing?
Eating breakfast.
I mean your face.
What, a pimple?
Durzo, you went to Benyamuri and you woke up half-breed.
Oh, that. What? You want to hear more? I talked last night more than I've talked in 100 years. You need to learn everything at once.
You're mortal now, and you're old. You could keel over at any moment.
Oh, you have a point. You saddle the horses, I'll talk.
Kylo rolled his eyes and began tending to the horses.
You've tried illusory masks. I've seen your whole little scary black mask thing that the Sakage found so impressive.
Thanks.
It had been impressive, dammit.
Wait, when did you see that?
In Caernarvon.
You came to Caernarvon? When did you come?
Too late to save Jarl, but early enough to save Aline. Now stop interrupting. You might have noticed there are some drawbacks to making masks of real faces, especially with disguises of people of different height from yours. I made some good masks in my time, but it was horrible work. And if someone touched you, or it even started raining, the illusion would break. Then one time I died, got a leg hacked off and bled to death. When I came back, as always, my body was whole. Look at yourself, dead 6 times and not a scar. How can that be? How could I regrow an arm?
I thought you said it was a leg. And what's that about Aline?
It was an arm, just remembered. I'll tell you about Aline later. What I figured out is that somehow our bodies know what shape we're supposed to be. I mean, when you cut away any man's arm, arm skin grows back there. Not a nose or another head. Why? Because the body knows what's supposed to be where. I figure that if that was the case, all I had to do to make a perfect disguise was change the instructions. Ha! If only it were that simple. I figured out a few things along the way. Like Ladeshians aren't just really tanned. And if you change your height dramatically, expect to be uncoordinated for a year. And don't mess with your eyesight. And don't change things about your body that you merely don't like. Pretty soon you'll be so damn beautiful people will stop on the streets to watch you. It makes for a lousy disguise. Anyway, it took me, I don't know, 100 years. I have about 20 bodies I do now. That is, bodies I've spent enough time in that I know how they work, understand their stride, their movement, their quirks. 20 is probably too many. But I got nervous once I found 2 different paintings of me made 200 years apart from different sides of Mid-Kiru, and obviously me in both of them. Some Alateran collector had the 2 hanging side by side in his study. I'd moved to Alatera to start a new life, and I was using that same damn body.
Wait, you're telling me you could have chosen any face, and you chose the nasty, ugly Durzo Blint face?
That's my real face.
Oh, by the god, I'm so sorry. I mean, I'm sorry I said that. Not that your face is...
Gotcha.
Bastard.
Anyway, it takes time to make the transition, especially when you start. And doing it halfway can be rather horrifying. We're on the trail, so we may meet people. If the skin on the upper half of my body is blackest Ladeshian, but my legs are white, or if half my face is young and half old, folks don't take to it too well. I can actually do it much faster now, but I figured I'd show you body magic that's merely intensely difficult before I show you the damn near impossible stuff.
Wait, does that mean you can make yourself look like anything? So, you could be a girl?
I don't want to hear your twisted fantasies.
Hey!
I've never been a girl or an animal. I have a small fear of getting stuck. Once I made a disguise that I was a man without a trace of talent. What was supposed to be a quick 1 month disguise while I infiltrated the Chantry instead took me a decade to undo and cost me my chance to recover the Silver Kakari. Being stuck as a fat Modaini? Bad. Being stuck as a woman? Ooh, unthinkable.
So why are you changing now? And what into?
I'll look like a 50-year-old rather affable Wade Rinner Count who appears to have a small talent that he's never tapped. Because the reason I'm leaving the woman I love behind and going with you to the Chantry, not my favorite place, is that I want to meet my daughter. In fact, I'd appreciate your help getting the disguise right. I'd like her to look at me and say, "Oh, I have his eyes."
But Kylo wasn't interested in that yet. He paused.
Master, what does it mean? The wolf called me nameless. If I learn to do what you do, I'll be faceless too.
If we can be anyone, who are we?
Durzo smirked, and even in another face, that bemused smirk was Durzo Blint through and through.
The wolf doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. I had a delusion once that every new life I started was new. Our gift doesn't give us so much freedom or terror. What we are is night angels, of an order ancient when I joined it. What it means to be a night angel is a harder question. Why do we see the Kuranti, the unclean? And seeing them isn't a compulsion, it's a sensitivity. There was a time when I could see a lie, but in the year before the Black abandoned me, I could barely see a murderer. What does it mean? Why was I chosen? Jorzan sometimes had the gift of prophecy. He told me I needed to take the Black. All history rests in your hands, my friend, he told me. I believed him. I would have walked through a wall of flame for that man. But 100 years later, all my friends were dead. The world descended into a dark age, and no one was even pursuing me. Maybe my grand place in history, my whole purpose, was to keep the Kakari safe for 700 years, until I could give it to you. You'll forgive me if that doesn't seem entirely satisfying. Imagine rallying an army. Come on, men, let's get together and... wait. But then again, if reality is hard and flat and unjust, then it's better to adjust to what really is than to complain that it isn't what you wish. That was what made me lose faith in prophecies, in purpose, even in life, I guess. But having lost it, soon I doubted my lack of faith. There were niggling hints of meaning everywhere. At the end of the day, you choose what you believe, and you live with the consequences.
So that's it?
That's what?
Choose what you believe and live with the consequences is all you've learned after 700 years? We're fucking immortal! And that's all you're going to tell me of why?
Faster than Kylo remembered his master could move, Durzo's hand lashed out. They stood looking at each other, silent. Mixed with Durzo's frustration, Kylo could see regret. But Durzo didn't apologize. Apologizing was one skill Achilles Thorn hadn't mastered in 7 centuries.
Kid, every place I've turned left, you've turned right. And now you want me to tell you your destiny? Would it mean anything to you if I told you?
It would tell me where to turn right!
Despite himself, Durzo grinned. But it wasn't enough to bridge the sudden gap. Kylo could see now that his rejection of the lessons Durzo had tried to pass on had cut Durzo deeply. Even if Durzo now agreed some of those lessons had been wrong. At the same time, Durzo was saying the same thing that the wolf had told Kylo long ago. Kylo had never accepted other people's answers. Not Durzo's bitter practicality, not Mamake's cynicism, not Count Drake's piety, and not Aline's idealism. Durzo was right about choosing what you believe and living with the consequences.
We're immortal. We're night angels. I don't know what it means. I don't know why we're this way or what we're supposed to do with it. Sometimes I feel like a god, and other times I don't feel like I change anything. If I'm going to live forever, I want it to be for something. I mean, you can't tell me that your destiny has been to hold the Kakari for 700 years until I came along. That's ridiculous. Terrible. It's not good enough. You're a great man, not a lockbox.
Kylo scowled. Gods, he'd just given Durzo a backhanded compliment. Exactly how Durzo gave compliments to him. Durzo's little grin told him he'd noticed, but he could also tell that the compliment meant a lot to the man. In all the times Kylo had been irritated that his master never properly appreciated how well Kylo did, he'd never really thought that Durzo might want to be appreciated too. Kylo hadn't bothered to tell Durzo how excellent he thought he was. He figured it was obvious. Maybe that was another knife that cut both ways.
Being a lockbox wasn't the destiny I chose. Right or wrong, or right or left. I've chosen to seek the Kakari, take them, and scatter them so those who would use them for evil can't. I don't know if that's what Jorzan foresaw, but it's what I've chosen. Has it been meaningful and satisfying? Sometimes. I've had some good lives and some that were just damn awful. Now that you bear the Black, I can lay my burden and my destiny down. Now I get different choices. So I'll train you until spring and see my daughter as much as I can. Then there's a woman I have to ask to love a man who doesn't deserve it. Your choices? Well, that's your shit.
Kyla loved Durzo, but the man sure was a pain in the ass.
From an older brother, the compulsion weave is weak, Your Holiness. It won't hold a determined Aethling for long.
I know. I was the son who was able to break it when my father used it on me.
Dorian had another dream last night and again couldn't remember it, but it had left him with a headache again. His talent for prophecy was healing faster than he'd expected, but for the time being it was useless to him. He couldn't remember his dreams, and the only thing that banished the pain was using the veer. It put him in a foul mood.
I'm sorry, Your Holiness. I'd forgotten.
The plan had come together with frightening ease. Dorian was his father's son. He'd spent days thinking about what he might have missed, and had found no flaw.
The oath is a distraction. You tell them that their reward for swearing loyalty will be choosing a concubine to marry. That will sound like a very Southron thing to do. Very weak. It will give the Aethlings hope. Hope and lust will keep them from organizing a defense. After each chooses, I want him led out by that concubine past his brothers, who will be waiting in line. The women should be dressed beautifully. And of course, they should know nothing, except that they are to lead the Aethling to one of the empty upper apartments. Each Aethling should be very lightly guarded, but heavily watched. You understand? These are my brothers. They're not stupid. On the way, kill them. If you have a handful of soldiers and 3 or 4 Wurdmeisters you know we can trust, that should be enough to take care of all of them, at least with the compulsion spell in place. Their faces are not to be destroyed. I will require a precise accounting and viewing of the bodies. When you're done, isolate any of the God King's seed who are too young to show whether they are witchborn. Kill them. Induce abortions on the pregnant concubines. Letting any grow up to see who's witchborn will give my enemies chances to smuggle them out.
Very prudent, Your Holiness.
Hopper's only expression was appreciation for a solid plan. It was brutal, but it wasn't cruel. Dorian took no joy in this. He would strike once to the root and rip out much of what made this kingdom a hell for its people. This way was kinder than waiting for dozens of Aethlings to coerce dozens of others into their plots. Dorian could wait and have executions every month for years, and his people would live in terror as dark as his father had encouraged. Or he could be as brutal as the North itself, and his people would live in peace, unafraid. It would be a clean slate, a new start. Dorian would be Wanhope, not for his own despair, but because those who opposed him must despair.
Yes, monstrous, but prudent.
Hopper didn't know how to respond. He bowed low. The God King dismissed him. It was a horror to be a god. On his wedding day, God King Wanhope waded in blood. He'd known that his father had 146 children, but seeing them dead and oozing and stinking, expressions frozen in death, bodies still warm, not all the blood congealed, was something else entirely. With Veer, he blotted out his sense of smell as he examined the boys. He'd run out of suitable concubines before he'd run out of Aethlings to slaughter. That meant that some of the women, each of whom had witnessed the murder of an Aethling she had expected to be her new master, had to make 2 trips. Only those who'd been spattered with blood were excused. It had worked, though, because the Aethlings who'd come later were the youngest and the least likely to pick up on a concubine's anxiety. They'd got them all. 3 of the older boys, 3, had broken the compulsion and fought, killing 1 Wurdmeister and 2 soldiers. In a perverse way, Dorian was proud of the boys. God King Wanhope took his time, steeled against the sight of dead children. Vipers, all of them. He was the fluke. He had always been the only one of his brothers with any moral sense. Vipers couldn't be tamed. He couldn't flinch now. He had to know if the job was done, or if he needed to be looking over his shoulder for the rest of his reign, for a Verdmeister who would hide his veer and betray the God King himself, as he had in his own youth. He paid special attention to those whose faces had been damaged. The next room was worse, though there was no blood in it except what came in on the God King's white robes. Hopper had gathered all the wives and concubines. The 15 women who had been pregnant were lined up against one wall. The God King walked past them, touching their swollen bellies and feeling no life within. Then he moved past the rest, feeling to see if any were pregnant. He took his time. A weave to hide a pregnancy was easier magically than disguising the dead, but a bigger risk for a Verdmeister. There was no guarantee that the hidden child would be witchborn, much less suitable for an ambitious Verdmeister to ride to the Caladoran throne. As he moved from woman to woman, he noticed something disquieting. There was no hatred in their eyes. He had made them help him murder 146 children. He had killed their unborn, but few wept. More looked at him with adoration, worship. He had done something beyond their comprehension, and it had worked perfectly. In short, he had acted like the god they expected him to be. Powerful, terrifying, inscrutable.
This afternoon, each of you will have a choice. As you know, the tradition is for wives and concubines to join the late God King on his pyre, except for those whom the new God King wishes to save for himself. You have served me well. I would give all of you a place in my heaven. Gareth's athelings will join him in the fire. Let them serve him in the afterlife. But if it is your wish, I will not forbid you to join them.
Now the women reacted as he would have expected. Some broke down and wept. Others stood taller and prouder. Some were still uncomprehending. But in moments, all dropped prostrate, hands stretched out for his feet.
I am walking blasphemy. Is there anything else?
One of the women, a curvaceous teen from the upper harem, raised two fingers.
Yes, Solana.
Sire, your holiness. She wasn't counted among the pregnant girls. She got real sick and went to the Meister so she wouldn't lose her baby. She never came back.
Dorian's stomach twisted. It was like hearing his own death sentence 20 years before the fact. He wondered if he'd dreamed of this and was only now remembering the dream, or if his dread was purely natural. He looked at Hopper, who paled. Hopper served at the lower harem, so the detail had escaped him, but he still looked aghast to have missed it. Dorian gestured, and the man shuffled out of the room as quickly as his stilted gait would allow. Juan Hope would send men to hunt this woman and whatever Verdmeister had taken her, but they wouldn't find her. Juan Hope had forgotten the first rule of massacring innocents. One always gets away. As Kyler and Durzo approached the chantry, the alabaster seraph gleamed, presiding over a city freshly dusted with snow that made it match its mistress. The waters of Lake Vistachi glowed light blue, tinged with red in the early morning light. They stabled their horses on the outskirts of town, and after speaking with an old woman who ran the tavern and seemed to recognize him, Durzo took a key from her. Eschewing the punts, Durzo led them across narrow, crowded sidewalks. Kyler gaped at the enormous seraph and at the crisscrossing currents that made the city's streets, bumping into strangers. Beneath his awe at the seraph, though, was a growing dread. He could feel V. He adjusted his sword belt. She was up there, up two or three stories. Her feelings were a mirror of his own. Durzo took them into a small dusty house with a thick door. Kyler noticed that his eyes and his master's checked all the same things. Doors, narrow windows, rugs, plank flooring. Durzo was satisfied. He opened the bureau and lifted out the bottom drawer to reveal a false bottom. Kyler pulled the kakari in his hand.
I'm really going to miss your wit.
If I wanted sarcasm.
Kyler willed it to cover retribution. Kyler dropped the sword into the space beneath the bureau. Both retribution and the kakari were magical. He couldn't bring either to the chantry. They would stay here until Kyler left. Durzo replaced the bottom drawer, locked it into place, and took a few minutes to place a trap on it. In the meantime, Kyler worked on his disguise as Durzo had taught him. After he finished with the trap, Durzo studied him.
Not too bad.
Minutes later, their little punt had scarcely docked next to a fishing boat flying two black flags when a familiar face turned up.
Sister?
There's a king in Cenaria.
Is this a password?
Glory to his name. Can we get out of the boat?
In Taurus Bend, I called you arrogant. You said you'd discuss your arrogance when there was a king in Cenaria. Was that your doing?
Me? Who am I to meddle with kings?
What's your name, young man? I seem to have forgotten. And who's this?
Kyle Glaxon. Nice to make your acquaintance again, Sister Aribel, right?
Ariel gave him a glare that could curdle milk.
This is Danik Bilson, Yuli's dad.
Seven hells.
Nice to meet you, too.
Kyla got out of the boat and Sister Ariel stepped close to him. She stepped back, confusion rising sharply in her eyes. She looked around the docks to see how far away the other sisters were.
What have you done to yourself?
With Durzo's instruction, Kyler now appeared to be a man with a vast and untapped talent. Otherwise, he smelled and looked like any man. As long as he didn't use the Kakari or his talent, his guise would remain in place.
I'm here to see my wife.
She's studying, but I can have her brought to you after lunch.
I meant the wife I chose, not the one you did.
Sister Ariel's face drained.
You have no idea what you're doing, do you?
Maybe I'm not the only one.
And you? Do you have demands that will cost lives, too?
I'm just here to see my daughter.
The funeral came before the wedding. Dorian didn't want the first thing he saw with his new bride to be insane women throwing themselves into a fire, shrieking as they burned to death. Nor did he want her to see the dozens of tiny bodies his men would throw on the fires first. He told Janine that he'd purged the Aethlings who'd been plotting against him, but he told her that he'd merely sent the younger ones away. Well, hell counted as a way, he supposed. Heaven certainly did. Dorian, of course, had never seen the cremation of a god king, but some of the older Meisters had. There was a ritual to be observed, despite the fraud at the center of it. Rarely had the body being cremated actually belonged to a king. But Gareth Rorsul's pyre wouldn't hold a substitute. Gareth had been a man deeply committed to evil, but he had been a great soul, too. A horror who could have been a wonder. And he was Dorian's father. Only Meisters were allowed to attend the divine funeral, but that restriction meant little, for nearly every ranking official in the Caladoran government was a Meister. Generals, bureaucrats, the masters of the treasury, and even the chiefs of the kitchen stood in attendance. Tax collectors and soldiers watched according to their rank. Dorian uttered the meaningless words of praise to Kali, and they uttered their meaningless refrains of devotion. The fires were started, and Dorian could read the veer of every Meister making a weave to block the acrid stench of human fat burning. When the fires roared hottest, Dorian had the harem brought before him and claimed almost all of them. There were raised eyebrows, but nothing more. A god king was expected to be voracious. The eight wives and concubines who'd chosen death were brought forward, and that was regarded as a small but adequate nod to tradition. The women had been provided with wine laced liberally with poppy, and six of them had indulged freely. Two were sober. All seemed content with their madness, not shrinking back even as the eunuchs lifted them to heave them into the fire. It was considered a greater sacrifice to Kali if their suffering were extended, but Dorian was already giving Kali more than her due. He should have forbidden the women to join Gareth. But if he had forced them to live, and they truly had loved Gareth, such women might have become a poison. Dorian watched their bodies sizzle and pushed the thought away. He nodded to the Verdmeisters tending the fire, and the blaze leapt higher, consuming the flesh and even the bones to ash. In minutes, it was done. Dorian lifted his hand to gesture that the wedding was to begin. It would be a simple affair, though lavish by Caladoran standards. God kings never wed, When commoners did, a man simply said, "I take this woman to wife." From the woman, only a lack of explicit protest was required. Dorian planned something grander for Janine, but not too foreign for his Meisters to stomach. But with his hand still raised, he paused. The moment had taken the eerie lines of prophecy. Dorian felt a sick chill and readied the veer in case there was another assassination attempt. Hoppo was whispering to a page who strode respectfully to Dorian's side. Dorian was looking at his grand white robes, at the assembled faces. He'd seen this moment in a prophecy. Why couldn't he remember? He inclined his head to the page.
"Your Holiness, Hopper wishes you to be informed that a spy has returned from Sinari. He reports that a man named Logan Gaia has been named king."
The world stopped. Janine's husband was alive. Dorian felt as if he were outside his body, re-entering the madness he thought he'd left behind with his prophetic gift.
"How dare you, God? What do you want from me? To tell her that he lives? I've given my soul for this, for you. I have become a monster, so I can redeem these people. Don't you care about me? Don't you care about this damned country? If you did, you would have saved these wretches yourself. I did not seek these chains of office. I did not seek the talent you gave me. I only asked for one thing. This woman. You made me with this yearning too deep for words. And you would have me sacrifice it at the moment the honey touches my lips. I have not forgotten you. I know the plans I have for you. Remembering me means nothing if you won't act for me. I have not betrayed you. You betray me. Nantaculum, I shall not suffer. You and I are finished."
God King Wanhope became aware of the stares of his Meisters. He smiled and completed the gesture to Hopper.
"Let our wedding commence.